are listening to KTWH. I'm Katya Gordon with a special weekly check-in with Greg Ruberg, our Lakeview Clinic and Hospital CEO. Greg has been generously calling us every week at this time and giving us updates. Thank you so much, Greg, for calling in once again.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes. It's wonderful to have you on, as usual. What's the topic for the week?
Well, the big discussion we've been having internally here at Lakeview, I think in our region and across the state, is on the modeling around COVID-19 and when a surge would be coming to Minnesota and more specifically to our region.
Yeah, no, that's certainly what's on everyone's mind. So I'm glad you're here to speak about that.
So there's a couple of different models that I think it'd be worthwhile touching base on. The first one is the one that I think a lot of people have been hearing about previously is the IHME model. It comes out of the University of Washington. And that's a model that's really much more conservative in its predictions, and I'll kind of walk through what that looks like and then compare that to the model that Minnesota is using and how why they're different.
Okay.
So the Washington model really looks at a peak of COVID-19 in Minnesota to be at the end of April. They specifically said April 26th. They do a death prediction for Minnesota 442. And one of the things that this model looks at, they really assume a large surge and then a drop-off, kind of like what you've seen in New York. It does not take into account kind of resurgent or a second lower-intensity surge or waves, as we call them. The other part of the University of Washington model that's been interesting is it really extends out until August. So it's not a full-year predictive model. It really ends in August. And so those predictions are much more, I think, timely or more focused down. Now, in contrast, the Minnesota model, which has been developed by the Minnesota Department of Health in conjunction with the U of M's School of Public Health and has been referenced by the governor many times, it really predicts a more dire picture than the Washington model or some of the private models. But I think the significant difference is it really predicts a peak into mid-July,
mm-hmm.
and so much farther out. The model, when they look at predictions of ICU needs and projected deaths across Minnesota, it goes out a full year. And so you see just much higher numbers.
Yeah.
It also includes multiple waves or surges, so not one peak. So, for example, you could have a peak, get through that, and then we open up more of Minnesota, and then you get kind of this a secondary wave or a resurgence of cases.
Yeah.
Again, there's a lot of variables that are unknown there. But
yeah.
I think the other one, the part of the Minnesota model, too, is it does predict the need for hospitalizations and really 3,700 ICU beds across the state. And what it does is it factors in the current shelter or stay-at-home order that's in place through May 4th that Governor Walz has put in place.
Yeah.
And that may change. But I think it's interesting to look at the two models.
Yes.
What I would say is from a hospital perspective, we look at both. We prepare for the worst, hope for the best, and try to be prepared anywhere in between.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this Minnesota model is the one that is guiding the governor's office on what's going to happen as far as opening or not opening things up May and June and July and even August, September.
That's correct. And so, yeah, it does a couple things. It does make sure that healthcare providers are well prepared in terms of the number of ICU beds, the number of ventilators, the number of cases, and how we open back up. The one thing that's new in the last couple of days is Minnesota has now joined with four other states in kind of a joint effort to look at how do we open back up each state in conjunction. So that has, I think it's still to be determined how that's going to look, if it means that we have shelter at home longer, or how that plays out. So I think more information will come out in the days and week ahead.
Okay. Do you have any inside knowledge or stuff that you can share with us about the testing? We hear a lot about testing and how important that could be to allowing us to open up by allowing us to know exactly who has the virus or at least getting closer.
Yeah, the testing has been the hot topic of the week for sure. So MDH is talked about and the governor has talked about in order to open Minnesota back up, there's really three or four things that have to happen. Number one, we have to test. We have to test broadly and test a lot. And so right now we've done about 42,000, just over 42,000 tests in Minnesota over the last, since we started 4 or 5 weeks or so,
mm-hmm.
say a month or more. Governor Walz recently came out this week and said he wants 40,000 tests done a week, which is over 5,000 a day is what he said for the daily count. So that's great. I think that meets the how do you open the state back up. The challenge is we don't have the testing supplies to do that. We just don't have the reagents, the nasal swabs. We don't have the capability to test at that kind of volume, especially, I can give you an example here in Two Harbors. we try to get more additional equipment to do this quick turnaround testing, but we can't get it because we're not designated a hotspot, which is good news. We have zero cases still. Right. But we just could never test to the kind of the volume that they're looking at in Lake County yet. And so that's a big challenge. St. Luke's has been able to get some allocation of the tests. They take about an hour to turn around. But again, we go through those very quickly because the testing criteria has expanded out to test more people, which is good.
Right. And isn't it true that, or what I have learned, tell us if this is accurate, is that there are definitely a significant number of people that are asymptomatic. So the more we test, the more people we find have it. Even people that, a large number of people that either don't have symptoms or have very mild symptoms. Is that true?
That is correct. The more we learn about this virus, we are learning that some people have had it, have actually no symptoms. Some have it, and the only symptoms that they have had is a loss of taste and or smell. Some are asymptomatic in terms of the fever. You know, the percentages vary, but that's the hard part about this, about opening back up, is we know there are people out there that either have had it and don't know, have it and don't know, before they become symptomatic. And so, again, the transmission is very high. It's very contagious. So it transmits quickly or spreads quickly that way. And so we really have to know who has it. So we talked about the testing, so that's one. The second part is the contact tracing, which I think we've talked about briefly before. And the kind of the philosophy behind that is when somebody is tested positive, you go back very quickly and find out who they've been in contact with and start to isolate or understand who they've been in contact with and where. And the third step in that isolation piece is that you start isolating people who are ill. So, again, you're working very hard on the testing, the where they communicated with or who they've come in contact with, and then the isolation piece for those people who are at risk. And, again, that allows you to open back up, I think, strategically versus an all-at-once, like saying on May 5th, it stays back open. That won't work.
Yeah. Can you tell us anything about what we know or what we are – I know we're still learning about the – how contagious a person would be who has had it, and I know there's now an antibody test that will test whether you have the antibodies. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that's called serology testing, and we've been talking about this internally here and on statewide calls as well. So serology testing really, it measures the amount of antibodies or proteins in the blood. So when you've had an infection, your body creates antibodies, and again, that's a response to the infection. So the serology testing really is trying to measure that. It's looking at the body's immune response to an infection caused by the virus versus testing for the virus itself.
Right.
There's a couple things that are interesting around that. Is number one, is it cannot be used to diagnose COVID-19 because you could test early on where there are not enough antibodies to trigger, and so it would not give you an accurate test.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is what we want to know is we want to test people and understand who's had the virus and overcome it. For a couple of reasons. Number one, they developed an immune response to that, so that's positive. And we're still trying to figure out is if you've been exposed and have had COVID-19, we don't think right now there's a guarantee you can't get it again. We're unsure. But it's a step in the right direction to understanding how that would work.
Right.
The other piece is there's about 70 testing options available right now for the serology. None of them are FDA approved, but Mayo's looking at about five of those, trying to vet those out to see if they could be used.
Okay, so as usual, there's a lot going on in labs and research centers working around the clock to help us deal with this and be able to function in society as well. Any exciting developments, Greg, with, you mentioned plasma testing?
Yeah, so there was an article this week, it was really interesting about the Mayo Clinic is doing some experimental treatment. This was out in Arizona. And so based on this serology testing that we just talked about, there's a treatment called convalescent plasma treatment. And what you do, it's an old-fashioned treatment. It's been around for a long time. It was used for measles and polio and conditions like that. And what you really do is you take the virus-fighting antibodies out of somebody's plasma that has had COVID-19. So they've confirmed positive for COVID. They don't have it at the time. You take the plasma out, you transfuse that into somebody who has the current infection, and then those antibodies are really beneficial in fighting off COVID-19. It kind of jump-starts that immune response.
Okay. So it's a potential, not a drug, but something similar that would help just help people that are already sick.
Right. The benefit of that is that, you know, the according to the report, is one donation of plasma could help five people. You know, they have to be compatible, of course, like with transfusions. But and there's some criteria. Again, you have to have tested positive in the past, symptom-free for 14 days, and that person donating has to have a negative COVID test at the time of the treatment. And so there's some coordination that has to happen there. But again, they think that that's one area that I think is an exciting development.
Sound exciting. I just have to ask, as a human, is that plasma test? Sounds a little scary. Is it not too terribly scary, I hope, to get your plasma taken out?
No, I don't know all the detail around that, but I know that, you know, people donate plasma now, and I don't think it's a significant process. I mean, people donate blood and they donate plasma. So I think it's the testing around that's probably the most important piece.
But again,
it goes back to our previous conversation, is we don't have the testing capacities right now to make this work to the level that we would want to.
Yes.
Because you have to test both the person that has it and the person that may have had it. And so there's a couple different paths there of testing.
Well, you've given me hope that what's happening on many different fronts, as it becomes more confirmed and as the infrastructure builds, that we will eventually be able to deal with this. It won't be, every week it's less new than it was the week before.
That's correct. And I think there's a lot of work happening around the vaccine side of things as well. And again, I think most of the listeners have watched the national news and read state news stories about there's a lot of people doing great work and a lot of work on trying to develop a vaccine. What we have to do is be cautious with that, is we have to get it right. So, you know, if a vaccine is developed, we want to make sure it's tested appropriately and approved, and because we don't want to use a vaccine that will have side effects that we just don't understand. But again, it's positive.
Yeah. Yep. All right, Greg, thank you so much. Is there anything else for this week's check-in?
I would just thank the listeners and thank Lake County for their continued good work as far as wearing source control out in public, maintaining social distancing, following the stay-at-home orders. I will comment, I was in the grocery store within the last week, and I was so impressed with, I saw one individual between customers and workers that did not have a source control mask on, and that was impressive. I think Lake County is doing a great job. They're taking this seriously. It's allowing us to have time to prepare, and I think it's, and again, I know we're all anxious to get the state open up again, as am I, but we want to do it right and save lives.
Great. Thank you so much, Greg. And part of that is you being accessible to us and the listeners of Two Harbors. So thanks again for coming on the station, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. Have a good day.
All right. You too. That was Greg Ruberg with the Lakeview Hospital and Clinic. You're listening to KTWH.